Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And with me in the studio today is Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Karen.
Hey, great to be here.
Marty Schladen, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Welcome back, Marty.
Good morning, Amy.
And Morgan Trow, Columbus Bureau Reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Welcome back, Morgan.
Good morning.
And in the end, all the chants and all the protests by students and faculty from around the state did not derail the controversial higher education bill. Republican lawmakers pushed it through the House with 58 lawmakers in support and 34 opposed. And once the Senate concurs on the changes, it will head to Governor DeWine's desk for a signature. Was anyone surprised? Lawmakers indicated all along that they had the right number of votes. Was anyone surprised that it went through so quickly and by such a large margin?
No.
No? Yeah, no surprises.
I mean,
yeah.
I this was a priority bill coming into this legislative session after Senate Bill 83 last session did not get to the House floor. There had been this whole discussion about whether there were the votes on the House floor to support it, which then Speaker Jason Stevens said there weren't. He said he wasn't blocking it from coming to the floor last time. The votes weren't there. He was a no vote on it this time, which was something to note. There were five Republicans in total who voted against it, but it was Senate Bill 1. That suggests that it was a priority, and I think that Senate President Rob McCauley and Speaker Matt Huffman have both said it was.
Can anyone recall a time when a piece of legislation had that amount of testimony and opposition and that amount of public protest?
No. I mean, this one, I counted all of them, removing all the duplicates. There was about 1,500 people who submitted testimony or testified in person saying that this would harm them. They opposed it. I mean, we have people from union workers to teachers to students to faculty members. Pretty much, you know, anybody who could protest went to do it. But there were about 30 people who supported it, mainly conservative think tanks and groups, some college professors or retired college professors, private school students, and a couple of public school students. So, look, this is going to be divisive. We're already hearing that there might be an effort to overturn it by citizens.
Yeah, what would that look like? Put it on the ballot? Is that?
Well, I mean, we saw this once with Senate Bill 5 in 2011, which was the bill that sought to restrict the collective bargaining rights of public sector unions like police and teachers. And you saw a huge union response. It was a record number of signatures that were gathered to put that before voters, and it was overturned by almost 2/3 of the vote that year. I asked the president of the Ohio Education Association, Scott DeMauro. He said there's discussions going on. He said it's too early to predict exactly what will happen. But I think this is moving from the focus and the attention paid to the student groups and the faculty groups and those groups who have been in opposition to now the union group saying they're concerned about it.
Isn't it likely also that people are going to go to the courthouse and sue over this? It would seem to me that there are some First Amendment implications and some right to organize implications here.
I would think so. I mean, lawsuits over legislation, we never see that, you know.
Now, this bill has a lot in it. I mean, we could spend the whole hour talking about what is in it. But in short, the GOP lawmakers are hoping for more conservative voices on college campuses. The other side is saying it's going to stifle critical thinking and cause students and faculty to pick other states, head to other states. I guess only time will tell to see if any of that actually happens. Right, Marty?
Yeah, I think only time will tell. I find it ironic that they dress this up as a diversity of viewpoints when actually it seems to me that they're trying to push a particular viewpoint.
And it does end diversity, equity, inclusion programs, which, we're hearing about throughout the state closing down those programs. Ohio State University even closed theirs before this bill had officially passed.
There is a carve out in the Senate version of the bill that would allow for DEI programs when it's required by state or federal law or when it's needed for accreditation or licensure. So there is some movement on that. But I think that was a big part of this. And Jerry Serino, who was the sponsor of Senate Bill 83 last time around and also the sponsor of Senate Bill 1, had said that even after he proposed this, before the bills passed, there were changes that were being made at public colleges and universities. And I think, you know, we're seeing that with Ohio State and some of these other schools. And it's happening on a national level as well. So apparently, though, the thought was that the bill was still necessary. And there's a lot of other things in the bill, like the ban on faculty strikes, which had been dropped from Senate Bill 83, which is now back in this version. So there was a lot more that was just, I think a lot of us want to refer to this as an anti-DEI bill, but there's a lot of other things in here as well.
Here's Representative Tom Young, who chairs the Workforce and Higher Education Committee, explaining why he supports cutting such programs.
The original purpose was to break down barriers, ensure opportunity, create fairness in education and workforce. For decades, it worked, but somewhere along the way, DEI changed. Instead of fostering inclusion, it has become a tool for division, enforcing ideological conformity rather than true fairness.
And did Representative Young elaborate any more on, you know, what changed to make these programs be so ineffective in his view? Do you know?
I think this is a Republican talking point across the country. And this is something that's been used in Republican campaigns, this idea that colleges and universities are woke, and everybody seems to have a different definition of woke when you start asking, well, what does woke mean? You get all sorts of answers if you get an answer at all sometimes. And so I think that's a lot of what this is rooted in, is a concern by conservative Republicans that whatever they think is the problem here, they're talking about it on a national level. It's become a campaign issue. I think that's a big reason why this has been front and center.
Now, it passed the House, or it passed the Senate first, and then the House did make a couple of changes. Do we know what sort of amendments they made? Was it anything major?
Well, just the carve out for the licensure, and also there was a amendment that specifically said that this bill would not prevent. And again, this is only public universities from providing services for disabled students and faculty and people. So that's something that opponents had brought up, saying this is not going to just affect people of different races, but also it will affect women, it will affect veterans, it will affect people with disabilities. And so I think this was an effort to try to push back on the idea that disabilities, that this is an effort to make a difference or change things when it comes to people with disabilities and what's offered to them on public universities.
And Morgan, the House made those couple of changes. So what has to happen next?
So it goes directly to the Senate. The Senate will concur on it. They already said they would. That will be a pretty easy vote. Then it goes to the governor's office. The governor has 10 work days to sign it or have it go into effect or veto it. He already said that he is very likely to sign it. So after that, 90 days later, it will go into effect if a lawsuit doesn't block it.
And we're going to hear from, let's hear now from Democratic Representative Desiree Timms, who spoke on why lawmakers really want to shut these programs down.
Not because these conversations are harmful, but because they challenge the status quo. Because they make people uncomfortable. Because they force us to confront the truths that some would rather ignore.
So what do you think about enforcement of this bill? So say it goes to Governor DeWine's desk, within a few days he signs it, and then 90 days later it goes into effect. What do you think is it written into the bill how they're going to enforce some of these things?
Yes. So parts of them have enforcement. Others are pretty vague. And I think that, you know, Jerry Serino said that parts of it are kind of broad, so it gives discretion. But we do know it basically has the elimination of tenure. So students will be asked to review their professors on if they believe they have been biased in the classroom. And there will be, you know, multiple instances of that. There will also be checks and balances, they say, in anybody can report that somebody is being biased or they're leaning a certain way, and that person will be immediately investigated.
And Marty, I would have to think that if a lot of this bill is being enforced by self-reporting, that leads you back to what you were saying before about opening it up to lawsuits, too.
Well, right. You know, obviously, tenure is a basic part of academic freedom, which is a free speech issue, you know, that enables people to give their opinions regardless of the political winds of the time. You know, in the 50s, Joseph McCarthy was hunting communists everywhere, and academic freedom on college campuses was really important. Who wants to really create an environment where people are pulling their punches and, you know, elite universities because some government agency is going to come investigate them? That just doesn't sound very free to me.
And when you talk about enforcement, there is the financial enforcement, too. Serino has said that the state provides funding for these public universities. And so if they're not doing what the spirit of the law intends, if there are problems, then legislators should not be afraid, he says, to pull back some of the funding that they offer to those universities.
This is the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. With us in the studio is Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal, and Morgan Trow, the Columbus Bureau Reporter for News 5 Cleveland. I wanted to move on to another education topic because everything seems to revolve around education these days. Governor DeWine was at the White House last week when President Trump signed his executive order to dismantle the U.S. Department of Higher Education. And DeWine spoke to reporters on Friday about why he attended and what he thinks about President Trump's move. What did he have to say, Morgan?
Basically, he said that he went because he was invited. He said that he wouldn't answer if he was president, if he would have done it. But basically, he said that, you know, it's good if the money goes back to the states, we're going to be able to do what's right for Ohioans. He did assure, I did ask him repeatedly, if we get that lump sum of money, how are you going to ensure that it goes to public schools? Because right now, I mean, $1.5 billion from the federal government goes to schools in Ohio. How are you going to make sure that goes to public schools? And he said, you know, it's going to be a give and a take. People need to reach out to their lawmakers to make sure that it goes to those programs. But he did say a priority for him would be making sure things like Title I to help low-income families and IDEA would help special needs families.
Karen, what did you make of the fact that DeWine went to Washington to watch this executive order be signed?
He was part of an interesting group of governors who were there. I mean, some of the most conservative governors in the country, Florida's Ron DeSantis, Texas's Greg Abbott. I thought that was interesting. But like he said, he was invited and he felt that it was important to be there. He, of course, just kind of overhauled Ohio's Department of Education and creating the Department of Education and Workforce. But when he was asked by Morgan and my colleague Sarah Donaldson and others about the funding and what happens now, because that, I think, is the real question, is there's a lot of federal funding. What, $3 billion in federal?
$1.5 billion.
That's a lot of funding that the state relies upon to go to public schools and to go to the voucher program, to go to all the other options there. And he said he thinks the money will be coming, but from other entities in the federal government. But that's the question, I think, at this point, is where is this money going to come from? What other entities, what other agencies is that funding coming from? And does this make it easier for the federal government to potentially cut off that funding? And then how does the state react to that?
There's also, I do want to make sure, so Karen is right with the overall number. So $910 million will go to Pell Grants, so that's for college students, but the $1.5 will go to K-12.
Policy Matters Ohio said that the state's 611 public schools, students, families, and communities, they had a number that they rely on more than $3 billion in federal funding a year. So that number must come from somewhere else. There's different.
Add those together.
I see. So they made a handy district-by-district breakdown of how much federal funding you get. You can get like a one sheet on every school district. But do you think that, you know, dismantling the U.S. Department of Education, is that going to impact the state budget like this year or is it next year? Like the money has to flow. I don't know. I don't know how the spigot works.
There's such a long timeline for public school funding. And so I think that we might see the real impacts in future budgets, especially when the department's been, the executive order dismantled, you know, started the process of getting rid of the Department of Education, but it's not 100% gone right away. So I think it's going to be a timeline thing. But I think there also is some concern. I mean, student loans is a big part of this, but also funding for kids with disabilities. I think that is a real concern among activists and parents of kids with disabilities, is what about that funding? Because there's funding that specifically goes to help those kids with their specific and unique challenges. What did you want to add, Morgan?
Yeah. So like Karen mentioned, it's a long timeline. Basically, just because Trump started this process does not mean it's going to happen in even, you know, the next year. Basically, with Congress being as split as it is right now, Congress needs to act in order to make this happen because it's in law that they have to change it. And so I know that some Republican lawmakers are saying that they're going to propose something as soon as possible, but Congress will need to delegate funding if they even do, if they just send it back to the states. There's a lot of different things that could happen. It likely will not impact this budget cycle because there's such a long process.
And once again, the courthouse figures into all this. You know, the Trump administration, Trump himself, want to look like they're doing a lot fast, but Congress created a Department of Education, so the president can't just issue an executive order and overturn, you know, something created by Congress. Same thing has happened with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He tried to shut it down. They're back at work. He's doing similar things at the Federal Trade Commission. You know, he may not like it, but the courts are going to have a say in all of this. But a lot of uncertainty about the future is being created.
And it's yet to be seen whether he's going to follow what the courts say, too. He says that as well.
That's a live question. Yeah, especially in the immigration realm. But now the director of the Department of Homeland Security is saying that they're going to comply with the court's orders. Mm-hmm. I saw that yesterday.
Well, for education purposes and for programming notes, we're devoting our 10 o'clock show tomorrow on this topic of education funding. Scott DeMaro will be here from the Ohio Education Association. We're going to talk to the 2025 Ohio Teacher of the Year. And then also Representative Tom Young, who chairs the House Workforce and Higher Education Committee, plans to be here. So you can learn more about all of this tomorrow at 10 here on 89.7 NPR News. Our reporter roundtable will continue in just a moment. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. Still with us is Morgan Trow, Columbus Bureau Reporter for News 5 Cleveland, Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Marty Schladen, Reporter at the Ohio Capital Journal. And I wanted to turn to the 10th District Court of Appeals, which partially overturned a ban on gender-affirming care for trans youth. What does this ruling mean for LGBTQ youth in Ohio?
Right now, what this means is that it blocks enforcement of the removal of hormone blockers and hormone therapy for trans youth. So basically,
you said it blocks the removal. So you're allowed to still have them. Yeah.
Yes. It allows you to have. So basically, that's how the court worded it. The initial House Bill 68 prevented some different types of hormone therapy for trans kids. That is now allowed. Only that portion is allowed. These puberty blockers are, doctors say they're reversible. What they do is just prevent puberty from happening for these kids. They're saying that this goes against the best practices of doctors and the rights of the parents to choose what they want for their children. So they have blocked that portion of it, but it will likely be overturned.
Because Attorney General DeBio said he will appeal. So is it likely to, this is going to be an Ohio Supreme Court issue?
Yes. And I think we knew from the beginning it was going to the Ohio Supreme Court. You've got two laws that are kind of together in this one, the ban on gender transition, gender affirming care for minors, as well as the ban on trans athletes and girls sports. This is only the first part of that. I don't know if there'd be a lawsuit on the other part.
They left everything else intact.
Yeah.
So this ruling only impacts puberty blockers and hormone replacement therapy.
And Republicans have found a lot of ground on trans issues and concerns over medical treatment for trans youth. They're basically finding it to be a political strategy for them.
Right? Honestly, yeah. Absolutely. And it has been. I think that there is a misconception on what happens when you are a trans youth. There are no surgeries that are happening in the state. It's not a full gender transition or gender affirming care. It is the precursors of, you know, making sure that these kids feel comfortable in their bodies and preventing against gender dysphoria, which we know is linked to suicide in youth. So what this would be is just, you know, preventing some mental health services. It would also, you know, block different aspects of care. I don't know what's going to happen with the doctors, though. I think it's going to be an interesting debate of if they are going to continue to prescribe that, knowing that the Ohio Supreme Court will likely overturn it.
Hmm. And I think not only is it a Republican issue in the campaigns, we saw that in 2024 in national as well as the state elections, but also I think you have Democrats who are now joining in this and actually turning more toward the conservative viewpoint here, that they have raised concerns. I mean, like Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, some other more seen as moderate Democrats who are actually taking the view that Republicans have had, that they're concerned about this, the role of these of this care when it comes to minors.
Hmm.
I think it's important to emphasize what Morgan just said, though. A large number of trans youth attempt suicide, you know, north of a third, full third of them. And there's research out there showing that as these laws get passed, that number goes up. And I just think that bears repeating every time this is a topic.
And that was one of the things that Governor Mike DeWine, when he vetoed the bill, had specifically said, that he felt like that if that bill were in place, he had heard from parents of trans kids that they felt like their children would be in danger, that their children might not be alive if a law like that were in place.
Hmm. Okay, I guess we'll have to see how it works its way out. Another topic I wanted to pivot to is the energy plan. Marty, the Ohio Senate last week passed an extensive energy plan. This is Senate Bill 2, so it's a high priority just after Senate Bill 1. It's meant to address a growing demand for power, especially all of these data centers that we're building. Can you give us a little overview of this energy plan?
It attempts to increase capacity, particularly through natural gas fired generators. And we have this expectation of all these new data centers. I think there's some important questions around that. We're shoving huge subsidies into the pockets of these tech companies. There's no evidence that they wouldn't build these centers here anyway. They're very energy intensive. They don't employ many people. And the DeWine administration hasn't really answered many questions about that. But, you know, I think there is broad agreement that we need more capacity. At the same time, I think a lot of people are happy that it ends OVEC, the Ohio Valley Electricity Corporation. It was created as a part of House Bill 6, you know, the most...
That's of Larry Householder fame. Yes.
Yeah, the most corrupt legislation in Ohio history. And OVEC was created as a sweetener for the non-First Energy utilities by subsidizing coal-fired, old coal-fired plants to the tune of $500 million. One of them isn't even in Ohio.
So this plan removes that.
It removes that. It ends that, you know. It also requires, it tightens up these quote-unquote riders that the energy companies get. They're just like add-ons to your bill. That's been a very problematic process. For example, First Energy had this distribution modernization rider. They couldn't show that they were using any of that money for its stated purpose, and they could even have been using it to pay bribes. So that's tightened up. The rate review process has been shortened but made more official. I think one issue, though, lies with the PUCO. They've got this long history of just giving the utilities whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And even when the Supreme Court declares some of these upcharges unconstitutional, the PUCO won't build in a mechanism to refund that money to the ratepayers. So I think there's a kind of broad agreement that some of this is a step in the right direction. I don't think that environmental groups are thrilled with all the additional fossil fuel capacity that's built in, but it's a big deal.
Is there anything in there about solar power?
Not that I know of, but I don't want to claim expertise I don't have.
Okay. And it was unanimous, which I think every time we see a unanimous vote, we're always like, really?
Really?
Okay. So.
Yeah. Okay. And have you heard from any environmental groups or the utilities? Have there been response to the bill, or is it just everyone isn't? It's unanimous.
I don't think anything this complex, there can't be unanimity because there are trade-offs when it comes. We all use a bunch of energy, and it comes at a cost, and it's, you know, a question of who wins, who loses.
So it passed the Senate, and so now the House will take it up?
Right.
Okay.
And I believe, according to my colleague Sarah Donaldson, who's been following this, this does end direct subsidies to some solar power projects. But I don't know exactly the overhaul, the overall on how it affects solar power and any other alternative energy projects.
Okay.
And as we know, there's been some artificial, some astroturf opposition raised to solar power. You know, it's fossil fuel companies that have got people up in arms about, you know, solar panels on prime farmland.
Hmm. All right. Well, we'll have to see what happens. Do you think it's likely to pass the House if it was unanimous in the Senate?
Definitely. Right. I mean, you guys are there every day.
I think there will probably be a little bit more discussion in the House. I mean, you have 99 members, and all of them have different points of view. I think some people are going to be mad because the OVEC plants are in their districts, such as Jason Stevens, who had previously said that he did not want to repeal the OVEC provision.
But I think there is widespread agreement that there's a problem, that these the energy demand, I mean, there's a report from the Ohio Business Roundtable that suggests that Central Ohio could be running into energy shortages in short order. And so something needs to be done to try to address this, even as the state is trying to bring in more technology companies and just servicing the data centers that are already here.
Yeah, I predict it passes pretty easily and quickly.
All right. Well, another bill that was introduced, and I'm not sure where it is in the process right now, is it would cut Ohio's income tax. Republicans are continuing to embrace the idea of a flat tax. Governor DeWine in his State of the State credited Ohio's low income tax rate, citing that companies move here because of that. Are we still discussing eliminating the state income tax?
Always.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the last seven budgets have included cuts to the income tax. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's almost always a bill that would either eliminate the income tax or flatten it to the current one would flatten it to 2.75%. You've got the two leading candidates on the Republican side for governor, Vivek Ramaswamy and Dave Yost, both saying they want Ohio to go to zero income tax. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this is something that Republicans have said for a while that they want to do. The question, of course, is
where do you get the money?
That's $10 billion that would be coming from the state income tax in this fiscal year. How do you make that up?
We also do not have a lot of tourism like Florida does. I think this could double the sales tax, which is going to hurt a lot of people's pockets. But I did ask at the beginning of the year, I asked Speaker Huffman if he was still planning on doing this. He said that he wants to do it, but he's not sure if it's possible this General Assembly. I think we're going to have to see, especially with the financial challenges and inflation and the stock market basically crashing. I think we're going to have to see if this is going to get as much support other than from, you know, a lot of the conservative population.
And in the Senate bill that's been proposed that would flatten it to 2.75%, Republican Bill Blessing, who's the chair of that committee, had said that it's important to note that the states that don't have income tax have other things, like Morgan was just saying, tourism. Or if you look at Alaska, North Dakota, and Texas, they have severance taxes, which are the taxes that are levied for the extraction of oil and gas from the ground.
Okay.
And that's when you go back to former Governor John Kasich, who wanted to go to zero income tax if at all possible. He had tried to propose increasing Ohio's severance tax, and that did not go anywhere. So if you cut one tax, you're going to have to offset it not only with spending cuts, but potentially with other sources of revenue.
That's exactly the point. I've lived in Texas quite a bit. Property taxes are also substantially higher in Texas than they are here. And as Morgan was pointing out, you know, if you flatten it out, supposedly, it all sounds good. Get rid of the income tax. But that's all regressive. And Ohio already has a lot of poor people. You know, more than a quarter of the state is on Medicaid. These are the people who are going to be hit hardest by this. And I think that people in the political class ignore these people at their peril.
Hmm. All right. Well, this is the All Sides Reporter Roundtable. You're listening to 89.7 NPR News with Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal, Morgan Trow from News 5 Cleveland, and Karen Kassler with the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Karen, you mentioned Vivek Ramaswamy briefly there. He's picked up some more endorsements. So Senator Bernie Moreno has now endorsed him. That makes, I think we counted 15 of 23 Republican state senators say they'll endorse him. So, what does that mean for his campaign versus Dave Yost?
Well, he's got the big one, and that was President Trump announcing his endorsement of him the day that he launched his campaign. That's the one.
Yeah.
And I think now you're seeing other Republican leaders lining up behind that. All of this goes against what Attorney General Dave Yost is trying to do. He's been out there running for governor for months now, and this hurts his campaign, arguably, but he says he's still in it, so we'll... Yeah. I mean, we've got a lot of time. My God, it's over a year. You know, when you tell people that these endorsements are out there, they think the race is this year, and it's not. It's next year.
Well, have we heard anything from Senator John Husted or DeWine on
Husted? You know, you have to look at that Husted and Yost were going to be running against each other for governor and think about that. But no, Husted has not weighed in on this yet.
Well, and we've got this wild card out there named Jim Tressel, you know, and
our lieutenant governor.
Yes, our lieutenant governor. And, you know, if he gets into the race, he will be the only one who has won a national championship as coach of the Buckeyes. you know, and I don't know. You compare that to an endorsement from Bernie Moreno, I know which one I'd rather have.
I think, though, the endorsements, the endorsement from Trump. I mean, boy, when you start weighing the endorsement from Trump versus the national championship, I mean, I think Tressel's starting to make the rounds of these Republican dinners, and would he be seeking kind of a co-endorsement? You know, who knows?
Well, but back to your point about the length of time involved, who knows how popular Donald J. Trump is going to be in a year, year and a half? We're in an extremely fluid environment.
I think that there's also time for people to change minds. I think, you know, we know that Trump likes winners, and we know that Jim Tressel is a winner, especially in football, which we know Trump likes. However, I'm not saying that he would go back on his endorsement for Vivek. I think it's interesting because Tressel would have the name ID in Ohio. People love him. But Vivek has the money. I mean, I know Tressel would be able to raise a lot, but I mean, Vivek could go on every single TV channel. He can put up so much money.
He already is, isn't he?
Yeah. Yes, he is. Yeah. There's already commercials on News 5 Cleveland. I mean, he has the money. Right now, he has the momentum. It really is going to be, you know, if Tressel gets into the race, which we don't even know if he's going to do.
Right.
Vivek Ramaswamy also has the endorsement of the leader of the state's leading Christian lobbying organization, which is a big deal, especially since Dave Yost has talked about his Christian faith and Vivek Ramaswamy is actually Hindu. But yet the leader of this Christian lobbying group has said he thinks Ramaswamy is the way to go. I think that while that doesn't represent the entire Center for Christian Values membership, it's still significant to know.
And even though you said that the 2026 governor's race is a long time away, I mean, Amy Acton was the first one to get into the race as a Democrat, and she's running a very quiet campaign, I would say. Do you think that she is being quiet?
Well, I think that with the Republicans, I mean, we saw what happened in the presidential. Of course, midterms, less people show up. It's typically better for Democrats, or it's better for people who aren't sitting in office as president. I think that Amy Acton is obviously the underdog in this race, not for the Democratic Party. Obviously, she's the only one. But just in terms of where our state is at, I mean, we are a red state right now, and that's just how it is. I have seen some attacks from Republicans, but honestly, they're not really focused on her. And I've asked different candidates. They don't see her as a threat.
Do you think that the Democrats are poising to have someone else run against Amy Acton?
Well, Sherrod Brown, former U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, just moved to Columbus.
Said to be with his family.
Yes. He has an announcement coming up in a little while about a Dignity of Work Institute, I believe, that he's going to be starting. That's the kind of thing that if someone were going to run for office, not in any way saying he might, but that's the kind of thing that you'd put your name out there.
He wants to be closer to five of his eight grandchildren here in Columbus. That's what's being said. But Jared's not the only member of his family with political aspirations. You know, his daughter was formerly the president pro temp of Columbus City Council. So maybe Sherrod Brown's moving here just for babysitting purposes.
Well, there's more than one office that's, you know, going to be available. You know, there's also a seat in the U.S. Senate that John Husted's going to have to defend after being appointed to that office. You know, and then there's the governorship. So maybe two Browns will run statewide.
We'll see. All right. This is the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. And when we return, we're going to talk about Cleveland Browns getting some funding for their stadium and also a cigarette tax. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News. Still with us is Marty Schladen, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal, Morgan Trow, Columbus bureau reporter for News 5 Cleveland, and Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. And Karen, I just lost my place completely in my script, but Karen, talk to me about the Cleveland Browns. There it is. Okay, Karen, the legislation has been drafted to include in the state budget $600 billion in a package of bonds to help pay for the domed stadium that they want to develop for the Browns. Now, the State House News Bureau, you obtained an 18-page amendment to House Bill 96. What did
that
say?
State budget.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And this is draft legislation, so it's not in there yet, but that means that there's the possibility that it will be. And this is a $600 million proposal to sell bonds for the state to back the sale of 30-year bonds, which would put the state on the hook for about $1 billion over that 30-year period. And then that money would go to the funding of this $3.4 billion dome stadium and economic development district around it. And this would be for the Cleveland Browns, though it would be 12 miles away from downtown Cleveland in Brook Park. And this comes at a time when Governor Mike DeWine had proposed a tax increase on sports gambling operators, saying that money should go into a sports facilities fund so these teams would stop coming to the legislature and asking for money to improve their projects. And this amendment would eliminate that sports facilities fund, eliminate the doubling of that tax on those operators, and start this process of selling bonds. Again, the state would have to pay back. Now, the Haslam Sports Group, which is the representatives of Jimmy and Dee Haslam, who own the Browns, say that there will be $1.3 billion more than this project would raise in tax revenue than the state would have to pay back. But the question is, where is that money coming from? What is the breakdown of that? How have those numbers been independently verified? And what's the mix of that? Is that sales taxes, income taxes, commercial activity tax? What? And when you've got lawmakers who are, as we were just talking about, consistently bringing up the idea of cutting the state income tax, what would that do to those numbers? So there are a lot of questions around this. And the big question I have is, if this is going to go forward, with which draft legislation suggests it's being seriously considered, when would it be inserted into the process? Is that something that would happen in the House budget, where there could be discussion on it and hearings in the Senate version, or in conference committee, where there'd be a lot less discussion and basically, it would just come out in the end, and it would be up to potentially Governor Mike DeWine to weigh in on it if he didn't like it. And it sure sounds like, since he's been defending his sports facilities fund, if this eliminates that, then that's going to be a problem for DeWine.
So the sports facilities fund, like increasing the sports betting tax, is that a no? That's a no-go.
In this draft amendment, that would eliminate that, and it would also add this bond package.
So whose idea is this? Where did
we don't know?
Okay,
that I don't. I don't know. There's no names attached to it. But certainly you do have several Republican lawmakers, mostly, who have been very interested in this. On our TV show, The State of Ohio, this week, I talked to Representative David Thomas, who's a freshman Republican from the Ashtabula, Trumbull County area. He's a former county auditor, and he is very interested. He said he was skeptical going in, but he thinks that this is a good deal for Ohio, that the state would get tax revenue out of this that would be in excess of what the state would pay for debt service on the bonds. But then also on the show, Democrat Terrence Upchurch, whose district includes Huntington Bank Field, where the Browns now play, yeah, and Jimmy and Dee Haslam's own house, he says he's very concerned about this and is opposed to any sort of a bond deal that moves the team out of downtown Cleveland and changes that whole environment there.
Now, there's so much in this. We're going to put the Browns' record aside, right?
I mean,
do you have to be a winning?
A lot of losing teams have come forward and asked for state funding across the country.
Do you have to be a winning team to get what you want?
And you
not
can put
necessarily
aside the deal that got Deshaun Watson to Cleveland, which a lot of people have criticized is not exactly the most financially responsible one in the world.
We're just going to throw money around left and right. You know, I'm going to keep my football bias out of this, but you know, go Steelers. Anyway.
That's a question. Yeah. I mean, and David Thomas actually brought that up, is a lot of people in his area of the state are Steelers fans. Mm-hmm. Why should they be on the hook to pay for the Brown Stadium? But the Haslam Sports Group's argument has been that there is enough benefit here that the state really, the risk is not there. The question is, can we rely on those numbers? Are those numbers rock solid? And if not, who pays the difference?
Marty.
We do. And I've been around the economic development game for a long time, and it's easy to promise the moon and stars, and, you know, 30 years later, people aren't even asking the question anymore. But I think the real question is, why do the billionaire Haslam family, why do they need more of our money? I mean, you know, we Columbus taxpayers paid north of $200 million for this soccer stadium for them. Meanwhile, we're living in a state where the Speaker of the House says we don't have enough money for public education, but we got enough money to build a football stadium for billionaires. I think that's an important question.
Morgan, you talked to the Speaker of the House directly about this. What did he have to say, Matt Huffman?
Yeah, so I asked him. He said specifically, and I've been following the school education funding intensely. He said that $600 million, which would $666 million, which would follow the Fair School funding plan, is unsustainable. And he prioritizes private schools. He says they're better than public schools. So I asked him directly, you know, what is more unsustainable, $600 million for public education or $600 million for a private stadium? He filibustered. He explained to me how bonds worked.
Meaning, when you say filibuster, you mean he didn't answer your question.
He just talked. He explained how bonds work, and then he said that the two aren't comparable. I followed up with that the next time I saw him, and he basically just said they're not comparable because one's a bond system, but that $600 million needs to come from somewhere right now. The Haslams want it right now. So if we're saying that public education, $600 million for that is unsustainable, why are we giving? And I'm from Cleveland. Like, I grew up. Like, the Browns are my hometown, like, stadium. They're my team. Why are we giving $600 million if we're saying school funding, which is a constitutional right in Ohio, is not available?
I don't know the answer to that.
not to play devil's advocate for the Haslam Sports Group, I'm just telling everybody what their argument in this has been, is that this is a benefit to everybody. They claim that they're also going to put $38 million up as upfront cash, which they say has never been done before in a sports facility funding deal, that kind of would be held in escrow to cover the payments if the funding isn't there. But there still are a lot of questions about specifically where that money would come from and the breakdown. And in that area of Brook Park where the stadium would be built, would there be enough interest in people moving there? Because there would be retail, there would be residential. Is that a place that people will want to spend time going to? Will they want to move there? And then also, Cuyahoga County Executive Chris Ronayne spoke about the Haslam Sports Group's own model, says the tickets would have to be around $800 each ticket over 30 years, they would have to grow to that. And every game would have to be a sellout. Every parking place would have to be a sellout, which implies to me that RTA, the Rapid Transit Authority, would not be doing a stop there because so there'd be no public transit. It'd be all people driving there and parking. I mean, the projections feel really, really big to people who are in positions of saying this is concerning.
There's also the whole, it would be a multi-use facility. So there would be concerts there. There would be, you know, playoff games for high schools.
Which are happening in other parts of the state already.
Yeah, exactly. And so the argument that the Haslams are making is compelling when they're asking for this because they're saying this will be for the greater good.
Because it would be domed and their stadium right now is not.
And yes, it's Cleveland, which is the snow belt of the state. it's cold. But I mean, how many games are they going to be playing is the question.
Well, eight a year.
And the eight home games this past season, even though they were 3-14, they were sellouts. So is that.
but there's still this fact of, is this the highest and best use of this money?
What about what about the Bengals? Aren't they going to ask for money? What about the Blue Jackets? Aren't they going to ask for money?
And actually, Representative Thomas said, hey, he wouldn't be surprised if other teams, other opportunities that other people would see coming forward would follow in the wake of this, which kind of raises the question, how much does the state want to get into the bonding business over and over and over again? But when it comes to things like games and concerts and that sort of stuff, a lot of that stuff's already happening in Ohio. Would that just draw it away from where it's happening and move it to Brook Park and take away from other parts of the state? The Haslam Sports Group said it's disrespectful to downtown Cleveland to assume there would be that sort of cannibalization, which I thought was a really interesting way to put it. But, you know, that's a real issue. That's
Are they going to upkeep their old stadium for things?
I believe they'd be abandoning the whole thing. But upkeep is another issue. Who pays for the infrastructure, the repairs, if it doesn't make the money that it is saying it's going to make, who's in charge then? Who makes those payments?
So I just want to talk about some of the basic economics here, too. You know, so Morgan was talking about her conversation with the speaker, and he acted like bond funds are so different from education funds. There's a fancy word for this. You know, all money is fungible. You know, money into one pot is money out of another, and that's just how it works. And so then you really have a choice between what is the best economic development tool, public education or a football team that plays eight games in a stadium that you got to, you know, pay $100 for a ticket to even go to. I've talked to economists over the course of my career who say that just what you said, Amy, education money is kind of a set pot, and it's just a question of where it gets spent. Are you moving it around? Or are you really growing something? And, you know, to say that public education is not as good as private education, you know, when I went to Ohio public schools, we were like the fifth best in the country, and it was free. And that meant that people got education and went to college, massively increased their earning potential. And, you know, to ignore these things is to just ignore basic facts.
Well, I think that what happens with this little $600 million inserted into the budget is a whole another hour show because we've just scratched the surface.
And again, it's not a done deal.
Yeah.
But it does look like it's on a fast track potentially, especially since there is actually draft legislation. What I'm interested to see at this point is some sort of independent verification of whether those numbers are real. and also the breakdown of, okay, $2.9 billion in economic activity is going to be generated. Where is that revenue coming from?
Morgan?
So I talked with the governor on Friday. He is not happy about this at all.
It eliminates his sports facilities.
Exactly. So he's talking about, so I asked him, I said, are you going to veto this? And he kind of didn't give an answer. He talked about all the benefits of his plan and, you know, how it would help kids with sports. It would, you know, prevent the Bengals from next year when they have, you know, their whole renovation renewal plan. It would prevent them from coming to the state. But then there's also the other aspect of me doubling down and being like, are you going to veto it? And he said, well, I hope it doesn't come to that.
But I think.
So do you think he was surprised by this? Did he seem surprised?
My story came out after her conversation with the governor. But I think when he talks about his sports facilities fund as being the way to go, and this would eliminate that, that gives you a hint on what he might be thinking. But I'm not a mind reader, so I don't know.
Him saying that he hopes it doesn't get to that point because he doesn't want the lawmakers to send it to him shows that he is very opposed to this.
Sounds like a threat to me.
Mm. Okay. Well,
and then, of course, the question becomes if it does, and again, it's an if it does get inserted into the budget and it does get vetoed, is there an override? And that would actually, you know, budget bills are interesting because everybody votes for budget bills for the most part because there's so much in there that benefits individual districts and that sort of thing. But when you start asking about specific provisions, now people are going to be on the record as being opposed or supportive of that.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you to Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Radio State House Newsboro. Thank you.
Great to be here.
And Morgan Trow, Columbus Bureau Reporter for News 5 Cleveland. Thank you, Morgan.
Always a great time.
And Marty Schladen from the Ohio Capital Journal. Thank you, Marty.
Thank you, Amy.
And this has been All Sides with Amy Jurevich and the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News.